Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our biosimilar series brought to you jointly by GAP and RAP. I'm your host, Gabriella McCarty, and your guide on this exciting journey through the world of biosimilars. Today's episode will delve into a critical aspect of biosimilars: interchangeability and switching. We are honored to have a distinguished expert joining us, Jeanette Villalone. Jeanette brings a wealth of knowledge and experience in the field, making her the perfect guest to shed light on this complex yet fascinating topic. So, in this episode, we will explore what it means for a biosimilar to be deemed interchangeable with its reference product. We'll discuss the rigorous regulatory processes in place to ensure patient safety while still enabling smooth transitions between treatments. So, understanding the nuances of interchangeability is crucial for us in GI and rheumatology, and for patients alike, as it impacts treatment decisions and access to affordable, effective therapies. So, without further ado, let's welcome our esteemed guest, Jeanette, to share her insights and expertise on the interchangeability and switching of biosimilars. It's a pleasure to have you on the show today, Jeanette. Thank you for joining us and being a part of this critical conversation.
Thanks for having me so today. I'm really honored and humbled to be here.
So, before we delve into the details of interchangeability, can you tell us a little bit about your background and your experience?
Sure. Let's see. So I graduated from Weill Cornell Medical College in New York City as a PA in 2000 and bleep, I'm just kidding, 2001. It's been quite a while. So I worked about a year and a half, almost two, at Mount Sinai, and then it was really time to come home. So I started actually at UCI in May of 2003, but in a different subspecialty. And then in October of 2014, I switched to inflammatory bowel disease with Dr. Namisha Parekh at the University of California, Irvine Medical Center. And this was pretty life-changing for me. This is where I really developed my true passion. I loved it from the beginning, the medicine behind it, the patients, everything. And shortly after starting an IBD, I learned that I had a huge interest in teaching others. And I really delved into that a little bit more because what I found out is that by teaching others, it actually helped me so much to grow as a PA in IBD. So I have now been a speaker very gratefully at GAP since pretty much the start. And every year I go, I'm just surrounded by such amazing APPs with expertise, not only in my field, but all other GI fields. And it is so motivating to me, and it just motivates me to do and be better, not only for myself, but the patients. So again, I'm really grateful and super humbled to be invited to speak here today.
Well, that's fantastic, Jeanette. I also love GAP. I think it's one of the best meetings out there. But your
Completely.
but your expertise will undoubtedly enrich our discussion today. So let's get started and uncover the world of biosimilar interchangeability and switching. So we'll talk about the basics and tell us why we don't refer to these medications as simply generics for biologics.
So, yeah, that is a really important question because I know that oftentimes, even when I discuss these medications with patients, patients will simply reply back to me after my discussion, okay, so they're generics. And so I do take advantage of the concept that the patients are already aware of, right? Patients are used to generics, they're comfortable with generics among a lot of different disease states. They know that it's less expensive. So, for their conceptual understanding, it makes sense, right? But I think that for us as advanced practice providers, we should understand the difference. So generics are smaller molecules that can be easily replicated by less complicated chemical processes. So these chemical recipes, if you will, allow for identical copies of the active ingredient to actually be replicated in an identical manner. So on the other hand, biologics are medications that are larger and have much more complex protein structures. And if you remember, require living cells and very specialized ingredients and processes for its production. For example, remember that infliximab is a monoclonal antibody that uses recombinant DNA technology from both human and mouse proteins in order to be produced. So as a result, biosimilars cannot be structurally identical to the brand name. The production of the biosimilars is just as complex, and there's a substantial amount of batch-to-batch variations in production that occur not only in biosimilars, but the reference product itself. So while they can be made to be very similar to the originator drug, they can't be made to be identical due to the complexity of the product itself. So biosimilars do contain the same active ingredient. They have the same mechanism of action. They have the same dosing regimen as the reference drug, and they do undergo rigorous studies to be chemically equivalent. But I want to kind of remind everybody that we're not really inventing a new class of drugs here. We're not, reinventing the wheel, but we're providing more options of medications within the same classes, which is really exciting because, as we know, biologics are so expensive. And by having biosimilars, hopefully, we will be able to offer less expensive options. As you may know, we already have, I think, three biosimilars for infliximab, nine, I believe, for adalimumab. And we may expect as well a biosimilar for ustekinumab called ABT04, which I recently learned got granted a license for its use in the US. So hopefully we can expect that in the near future, which is really great for us.
Wow, thank you for that excellent summary. So, what do companies need to demonstrate to the FDA in order to be approved as a biosimilar?
So, very good question. So, biosimilars are approved by the FDA because they have to have comparable strength, dosing, efficacy, immunogenicity, side effect, and safety profile as the reference product. So, that's a big ask in and of itself. So, essentially, they must demonstrate to the FDA that they are chemically equivalent, pharmacokinetically equivalent, and can be interchanged with the originator drug. More importantly, they have to undergo extensive studies to demonstrate to the FDA that they can offer a safe and uncomplicated transition from the brand to the biosimilar product without any increased risk, side effects, compromise of efficacy, immunogenicity, etc. And a way to do that is by conducting switch studies. So switch studies are actually clinical trials, randomized clinical trials that are performed in order to demonstrate to the FDA that the patient can easily transition from the originator to the biosimilar without compromise of efficacy, safety, and immunogenicity. And there are some important trials that I encourage the audience to familiarize themselves with in order to get an idea of how they work. But they are randomized clinical trials. Patients will either stay on the originator, and then others will be switched to the biosimilar. And then, of course, that is where the testing comes in terms of matching their comparability.
So, speaking of pivotal trials, do you have any that you recommend, Jeanette?
Actually, I do, because I do remember when I started in IBD and I would go to all these conferences and you hear these amazing thought leaders make references to these trials. And there's so much data in IBD that I would be so overwhelmed. And so I have to go back and kind of look up these trials that they mentioned. So I am still learning, just as everybody else is that's listening to me. So I do have to give credit where credit is due. I recently was listening to a podcast with Dr. Christina Ha from the Mayo Clinic, who is just an amazing IBD clinician as well as educator. And I learned a lot from her, even in her podcast as well. And so she actually did mention some key studies that really helped me. And so I would like to now share it with everybody in the audience because I think it's worth understanding. So first of all, we have biosimilars for infliximab and adalimumab, and hopefully shortly for ustekinumab. We have a little bit more familiarity with the infliximab trials just because they've been around longer. But it's interesting because the two trials that she had mentioned that were kind of the first biosimilars with infliximab was the PLAN-A-TRAS study that came with the from the disease state of rheumatoid arthritis, and the PLAN-A-TAS TAS trial that came from the disease state of ankylosing spondylitis. And these really set the stage for biosimilars with infliximab that have been, like I said, around a little bit longer now. For adalimumab, the Voltaire study that was done in plaque psoriasis patients also analyzed patients and switching from adalimumab to the biosimilar. They found pharmacokinetic equivalence and comparable efficacy when switching. The Voltaire CD study is actually specific for Crohn's disease patients, and this was studied by Dr. Stephen Hanauer, another well-known authority and leader in the IBD world. And in his study, again, he showed the comparable safety and efficacy in Crohn's disease patients when being treated on adalimumab to switch to the biosimilar, and again, demonstrated that there was no clinically significant difference in efficacy or tolerability of the study. Another important trial is the NorSwitch trial. And this was an important trial because it was a randomized clinical trial that took the data a step further, if you will, because this study didn't study patients just in one disease state, but it across multitude of disease states. So they took stable patients on infliximab and that were patients, again, amongst various disease states, and then switched them to a biosimilar and kept them on a biosimilar. And so again, they found that switching patients from the originator drug had the same results as the other studies, which didn't show a worse outcome when compared to patients that stayed on the reference drug. And this study also looked at infliximab drug levels and also found consistency across the board. And again, this was really pivotal because it took patients from various disease states and they still had the same outcomes. So these are just to name a few, but at this point, we have so much data out there that providers and patients alike should really feel comfortable in using them.
Well, thanks for that great information and a breakdown of these very important studies. One of the terms that we hear a lot when it comes to biosimilars is interchangeability. Can you explain a little bit of what that means?
But one thing I do want to point out, when it comes to interchangeability, we should note that not all biosimilars are interchangeable or deemed interchangeable by the FDA. So by definition, interchangeability in the US means that the biosimilar product is allowed to substitute the reference product without requiring the physician or healthcare provider to rewrite the prescription. So essentially, it allows for, quote, pharmacist level intervention, where a pharmacist can substitute the brand name for the biosimilar if the state law permits. Now, currently, all 50 states in the US and the District of Columbia have laws regulating interchangeability. However, states may vary in terms of the pharmacy laws and practices that regulate what is the appropriate management of switching biosimilars. For example, Do they need permission from the healthcare provider? Do they need to inform patients of the switch? How do they document patient the switch of the drug? Is it necessary to document? So, for example, do they need permission from the healthcare providers to make the switch? Do they need to inform patients of the switch, and how do they provide that information? And they regulate the necessary documentation to legally make the switch. So to be considered an interchangeable biologic, pharmaceutical companies have to take their testing that extra mile. They have to apply for this title. They must demonstrate that the biosimilar meets these additional, quote, interchangeability requirements that are very strict and stringent set by the FDA in order to be considered an equivalent drug. So in order to get that interchangeability certification, if you will, it requires an application and additional data as set by the FDA. And again, not all biosimilars have that designation. As a matter of fact, the only FDA-approved interchangeable biosimilar in IBD, not just in IBD, but the only FDA-approved interchangeable biosimilar is Ciltizo, which is an adalimumab biosimilar.
Wow, that's a lot of information and all great. And we'll move on to another topic. I'm sure that many of the audience here have heard the term indications extrapolation. Can you explain what that means?
Sure. This is an important term to understand as it applies to biosimilars, because it actually may cause some doubt or questions in some of your patients if you're using a medication that was actually studied in a different disease state patient population, right? So for example, we discussed the initial pivotal trials of infliximab were actually done in rheumatoid arthritis and ankylosing spondylitis. So what this means is if a medication meets the criteria to be an FDA-approved biosimilar for one disease state, then we can extrapolate that data and say that the biosimilar is also clinically, chemically, and pharmacokinetically equivalent for all the other disease states. So this makes sense from a financial perspective, right? As well as from a time perspective. Imagine having to do randomized clinical trials on the biosimilar for adalimumab, for example, which currently has, I believe, 10 FDA-approved indications in the U.S., and then having to do a study on each indication. So who can afford that? How long would it take in the real world to perform? And that would definitely impact how quickly we can get these drugs out on the market to start helping people. So by being able to extrapolate data from other disease states, it saves us time, money, and ability to start treating patients quicker. So, and also we have that data from the North Switch study, which makes it all that important, if you remember, is that the patient population included in this study was from all across different disease states, and the results were the same. The biosimilar continued to show comparable efficacy, safety, and immunogenicity to the reference drug. So again, this is another reason why this North Switch study is so important, because it really brings to light how important indication extrapolation is and that it actually works.
Yeah, well, that makes a lot of sense now. Thank you for that information.
Of course.
So it's been such a great discussion so far. And we'll shift gears a little bit and talk about more practical aspects and some key take-home messages. And some of these questions, we need like nurse practitioners and explaining to patients and focusing on patients. So in your opinion, what does interchangeability mean for APPs utilizing biosimilars?
So very good question, right? Because sometimes what's important to the provider may not be so for the patient. So so frankly, in IBD, we do have one biosimilar that is actually FDA approved as a recognizable, interchangeable biosimilar. So the one biosimilar for adalimumab that has proven interchangeability is Ciltizo. So while achieving the designation by the FDA lets us know that it did undergo more stringent evaluation and study to meet the demands of the FDA, I am still amenable to using the biosimilars for infliximab and adalimumab, even if they didn't achieve that designation. I think the data we have available right now for the biosimilars in terms of chemical and pharmacokinetic equivalency, efficacy, safety, and immunogenicity really is so robust, it makes me very comfortable in prescribing them and switching them. And not having the interchangeability designation would not necessarily deter me from prescribing and using them.
I agree with you completely on that. And ultimately, if a patient cannot afford a medication and they're not going to take a medication, right?
Then, exactly.
So yes, I have no problem interchanging between those for infliximab and adalimumab. And ultimately, a lot of times it's an insurance company that decides for you, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it really does. That's a really important point because so when it comes to patients, they care about a couple of things, right? So when patients are sick, they want to get better. So they want to know, does the drug work? And how quickly does it work? And is it safe? And they not only want to know what the data shows about safety, but they want to know our experience as providers, right? And ultimately, how much it's going to cost them. Because sadly, in the US, we know that our system needs a lot of work. And it is really a shame that patients have to be ill and have to even think about cost and money, but they do. And biologics are terribly expensive. And biosimilars offer more options and more competitive prices. So hopefully we can bring that cost down. So you're absolutely right that insurance companies are going to start dictating, as they already do, our care. I'm sure you have that same experience, is we put in orders and it isn't the pharmacies coming back to us going, hey, this is an issue. It's the insurance companies. So insurance companies will tell our off coordinators, this is denied, the brand name is denied, and this biosimilar is what we're contracted with. And ultimately, we make the switch. In my practice, we already have it set that if the insurance company denies the original drug and wants the patient to use a biosimilar, we don't appeal to the insurance company for the brand name, because our ultimate goal is to get the patient treated as quickly as possible and not waste time in fighting changes for a brand name, because ultimately it could delay care and potentially put the patient at risk of flaring or getting worse. So frankly, I don't have any concern in switching. So if an insurance company says, this is the switch, we have data to support it, I have experience to use it, and we go ahead and do that without much intervention or fighting back, if you will.
Yes, that's exactly what we do as well. But it is important to be transparent with patients.
Correct.
And how do you discuss this interchangeability? Do you let patients know ahead of time, or if they go in for their next infusion and it's a different medication? Some patients do get a little upset with that when they're not getting the brand name.
Yes, they do. And we get a lot of questions because oftentimes people will get that information from the infusion center itself that they're no longer covered. And I don't, from their end, I don't know how they handle that. So they end up calling us. And, you know, what ultimately I have learned is that when I have this conversation with the patient, what they really want to know is, some patients really want to delve into data and all of these things, but what they want to know is, look, I'm feeling great on my brand name drug. I feel great. my energy levels are great, I'm doing well. And we have to take into account their perception and perspective of that. Because, so for example, what I tell patients, and here's where the humanity of healthcare comes in, right? Because patients want to know, is it going to work? And I can shower them with data. But ultimately, a patient in a clinical trial may be a number, but to us, there are patients. They are individuals. They're unique individuals with their own lives, their own genetics, their own problems, their own fears and anxieties, trust, lack of trust, their concerns, their own personal family histories of cancers and malignancies, their experience with medications and side effect. Everybody is different. So when I talk to them, I can't look at them and guarantee, hey, look, no, you are going to feel 100% the same, because I can't. I'm honest with them. I tell them what the data shows. I tell them that we're comfortable in switching, but everybody has their own experience with their own drugs. And I don't know if they're going to, quote, feel the same. So there is something very important in clinical practice, and that is the nocebo effect, right? Mm-hmm. So this is essentially a patient's perception that by changing a drug, they will have a worse outcome or side effect, right? Because they feel so well, they're scared that they won't feel as well. And that will come into play with some patients. So I have had patients tell me, actually, well, look, after getting their biosimilar, I got my first infusion with the biosimilar, and I'm just more tired, and I don't have the same energy as I did on the original. Or I've been noticing more headaches on the biosimilars, or my skin is more itchy, right? I can't control how the patient's going to feel. So, of course, I'm going to go in, I'm going to work them up, I'm going to check inflammatory markers, labs, I'll check my calprotectin. I may even perform endoscopic evaluation, right? Because some patients feel like they have more diarrhea or more abdominal right. pain, right? Mm-hmm. And they may show signs of clinical remission. But the patient continues to say, look, I still don't feel as well. Energy levels are down. Something's off with this drug. I cannot force them to stay on a biosimilar just because the labs are good. I don't have that in me. And at that point, I am going to advocate for my patient, right? At the end of the day,
that's when
I have
you'll
to say
do that appeal, right?
Right. That's when I'll appeal and I'll say, look, this is what my patient is experiencing because they're their own universe. And my job as their provider is that they're living their best life, right? We follow STRIDE guidelines. We treat to target. We make sure that all the targets are met. But at the end of the day, there's an individual behind that. And my job is that they feel well and that they're living their best life.
Exactly.
And if I have to advocate for them and switch the drug, you know, I will.
And
because
document,
again,
document, document.
And document, document,
document,
document. Absolutely, for sure. So, and I think that's what we all feel as providers, right? We get really caught up in such wonderful data, but we have to remember that everybody's different. Why does one person respond to infliximab, but another person is a primary non-responder? Who knows, right? Why?
Right.
But they turn around and they respond to vedolizumab or another drug, right? Everybody's different, and there's
everybody
intricacies.
Has a different makeup. Sure.
Exactly.
Yep.
So we just have to do what's best for our patients and advocate when we need to, for sure.
Exactly. So that was an amazing discussion, and that actually wraps up another episode of the Gap and Wrap Biosimilar series. And we hope you come away from this episode with a better understanding of interchangeability and switching, you know, what it means for APPs, what it means for patients. And I really, really want to thank you, Jeanette. That was excellent. You had very valuable insights and expertise on this specific topic.
Thank you so much. Again, I'm really honored to be here. If anybody learns anything from today, I'm super excited about that. And just, you know, keep on taking the best care of our patients. That's all that we can do.
That is certainly right. So thank you for listening to this episode of the Gap and Wrap Biosimilars podcast series. And I'd also like to give a shout out and thank you to Pfizer and Amgen, because without their continued support of APP education, this podcast would not even be possible. So please see our show notes for learning objectives from this episode and fill out our evaluation so we can receive feedback. Make sure you join us next time as we discuss the interplay of managed care and biosimilars. So remember to follow our podcasts, Gapcast and Rapcasts, so you don't miss an episode. Again, thank you for joining us on this journey of discovery. And until next time, this is Gabriella McCarty signing off. Take care.